Welcome back to Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host. Jimmy Akin, our guest this hour. Jimmy is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers. He's the author of the brand new and very popular book, The Bible is a Catholic Book. We will talk about that as we go. He's also the man behind Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Hello, Jimmy Akin.
Hello, Cy Kellett.
Thank you for being here with us.
Oh, I'm happy to be here. I had to be somewhere, so it may as well be here.
That's touching the way you phrase that.
And you know what the great scientist Buckaroo Banzai said? No matter where you go.
There you are.
That's right.
Man, I haven't seen Buckaroo Banzai for a long time. That's years and years and years ago.
Yeah.
One of the greats.
Fun movie. Not my planet, monkey boy.
Yeah, and he sings that song. I got to remember what it is. Weird questions today.
Yeah.
We got a lot of weird questions for you.
Okay.
Did you bring your weird mind?
I can't really easily leave it behind. Yeah.
That's true. That's true. Some people do try to leave their mind behind on a Friday night.
Some people lose their minds, I hear.
Yeah, that will happen as well. That happened to Evelyn Waugh, you know.
Uh-huh. He lost his mind?
He lost his mind, and he went to what I think at the time was called a sanatorium, but I can't remember.
He didn't go to a mind finder?
He did not go to a mind finder. But I really admire Evelyn Waugh because he wasn't ashamed of that. People said, where have you been? And he says, I went crazy. I lost my mind, but I'm better now. I admire that.
And it you know, mental illness used to have a big stigma around it.
Yeah.
But people being open about things like that helped overcome that.
Right, right. You ready for Kevin's weird question via
sure.
email? Okay. I'd like to know about the so-called satanic panic around Dungeons and Dragons, but also the related panic about Dungeons and Dragons and murder/suicide. I'm a big fan of tabletop role-playing games. I think most people of faith have gotten over the panic around the topic, but you still see it sometimes. I have, for example, seen Dungeons and Dragons listed on a confession guide. I'm going to read the whole thing because it's an interesting question. I mostly think this is silly, and it's certainly not the case that Dungeons and Dragons involves real spells or is a gateway to the occult. On the other hand, I definitely have seen the ways in which, especially in the modern RPG community, role-playing game community, these games can become an almost religious practice for people. A lot of newer independent role-playing games use the medium to explore unhealthy fringe moralities.
Okay, so let's go down this a piece at a time and talk about it.
Okay.
The first thing that he referred to, the satanic panic, was a thing that happened kind of in the 1980s and to some extent the 1990s. There were a number of fundamentalist Christian groups in particular who would argue that Dungeons and Dragons and other similar role-playing games were quote-unquote satanic.
Yeah.
And, you know, Jack Chick was an example of this. He published one of his comic tracks called Dark Dungeons that was specifically devoted to this theme.
He also thought one of my favorite institutions was satanic.
Yeah, he thought the Catholic Church was.
Yeah,
so,
right.
You know, he kind
Thanks,
of put
Jack.
Us in the same camp as Dungeons and Dragons.
Yeah.
This is something that was based on the fact that Dungeons and Dragons in particular incorporated elements of fantasy magic, not unlike other things like Tolkien's Lord of the Rings or the Chronicles of Narnia or lots of classic Western literature.
Right.
But because it had some of those concepts associated with it, even though it was just in a fantasy setting, there were no actual spells that people would say or anything like that. Just any association with magic is enough for some groups to accuse you of being satanic.
Mm-hmm.
That is not the attitude of Catholic moral theology. Real magic is bad, but watching a movie or reading a book or playing a game or doing a stage play where some of the characters use magic is not, or even talk to demons like Faust, is a cautionary tale about, you know, do not sell your soul to the devil. It will not end well for you.
And I learned the lesson.
Yeah. All of those are potentially legitimate. You know, you can put on, for example, a version of the Passion Play that might have Satan as a character working behind the scenes, inspiring Judas. In fact, if you watch Mel Gibson's movie, The Passion of the Christ, you've got something like that.
Mm-hmm.
So creating imaginative forms like movies, plays, games, books, whatever, that involve magic or the occult or demons are not themselves problematic, and not in and of themselves. They may be problematic, but they're not automatically problematic. And so the satanic panic kind of passed. But there was another panic, which he also refers to, that was sort of a mental health panic, because there were people who, so people who play Dungeons and Dragons, like any game, are people in a fallen state, and some of them are broken, and some of them do things they shouldn't do, like try to kill their parents for a $2 million trust fund, or fake your own death to get away from your controlling mom by hiding in underground steam tunnels under your campus and then hiding out at a friend's house for a month.
These sound like real things.
Yeah, they were.
Oh, okay. Because it was so specific. I was like, this has to be a real thing he's referring to.
Yeah. So, so when these things happened, people noticed, oh, this guy who tried to kill his parents for the trust fund, or kill his stepfather for the trust fund, he played D&D, and so his friends were D&D players, and he tried to rope them in on the plot. So D&D must be at fault, not the $2 million trust fund and the criminal intent of the individual. Same thing with the guy who like hid out in steam tunnels and then, you know, camped out at a friend's house for a couple months to get away from his mom. Oh, he was a D&D player, so it must be the D&D that was the fault, not the controlling mother he was trying to get away from, or the fact he was a young guy who was running away from home.
Yeah.
And so the moral panic also passed, because it became clear with the course of time that whatever you may say about people who are into D&D, they aren't systematically turning into murderers and suicides. You know, there's no statistical data showing that the murder-suicide rate is higher substantially among them than among anybody else. So those panics kind of passed. Then there are lingering effects, though. And the if I was reading an examination of conscience in preparation for confession, and it had something like, have I played D&D in it? My estimation of the preparer of the guide to confession would go down somewhat, because this is not of itself a problem. This is, I would say, this is a Jansenistic scrupulous tendency.
Yeah.
Having said that, there are problems because human beings, you know, there are problems in this area, just like there are in every other area. Could you read the last part of the question again?
Yeah. On the other hand, I've definitely seen the way in which, especially in the modern role-playing game community, these games can become an almost religious practice for people.
Okay, so let's stop there.
Okay.
By almost religious, that is kind of loaded terminology. Mm-hmm. There are people in any activity who use it, who get obsessed with it, or who really get into it, you know, and it can be any kind of activity at all. It could be rock climbing. It could be exercise. It could be dancing. It could be playing music. It could be all kinds of things. People develop obsessions, some of them to an unhealthy extent. Other people just get really into something, and it, you know, they meet other people who are in it. It forms a kind of community for them. That's not of itself unhealthy, just being a fan of something and meeting other fans. So if someone is to the extent of being obsessed with something to where they're neglecting other duties, well, then that's bad. But I would hesitate to compare it to a religion. Then, and the other thing that Kevin mentioned was there are various groups of gamers who, in gaming, explore unhealthy moral situations. And that's true, but that's no different than reading books that explore unhealthy moral situations. There are lots of, you know, books and movies and TV shows that portray unhealthy moral situations as if they were cool or acceptable, or that glorify them and so forth. And so the fact that some gamers do the same things when they're doing their games, that's just another sign of human brokenness. But it doesn't mean the game itself is intrinsically bad. Having said that, now, thus far, I've largely said, you know, with games in general, there aren't role-playing games in general, they're not necessarily bad. Some of them, like, are, for example, superhero games, where the point is being good and doing good and saving people.
Yeah.
There are even Christian role-playing games where saving souls or battling the devil are, you know, like your character may be Michael the Archangel or something. These are, or that teach the virtues. You know, these can be very positive. Having said that, there is a spectrum, and some games have problematic design elements built into them. And I would cite D&D as an example of this. I'm not prepared to condemn every group of D&D gamers out there or every D&D game, by no means. You can run a D&D in a healthy way, but the game has a problematic design element in it known as alignment. Alignment is a the moral disposition of your character. So, and it's kind of a, it's not a square of oppositions, but it's, you have good, neutral, and evil, and then you have lawful, neutral, and chaotic, depending on how much they follow rules versus how much they violate rules and whether they tend to be good or be bad or somewhere in the middle. And characters are authorized to have, players are authorized to have characters with any of those alignments. And in fact, if they want to play a character of a certain race, let's say a dark elf, well, what kind of alignment would you suppose a dark elf might have? And it's probably something in the evil zone, right?
Yeah.
Hence the name dark elf. And so characters are expected to play out through, players are expected through their character to have their character act in a way that's in accordance with its alignment.
Okay.
Now, this is not in principle different than an actor playing a role, and actors can morally play roles where the character does something bad. Someone has to play Judas in a passion play.
Sure. Right.
Someone has to play Pontius Pilate in a passion play.
Right.
But you need an actor who recognizes the evil that their character is doing and internally separates himself from it.
Oh, yeah, right.
And so it's not, I'm not getting into this. I'm not, I may be physically acting out this part and saying these lines of dialogue, but I'm not going to let myself cross that mental line in doing it.
Right.
But the problem is lots of actors in Hollywood cross that line.
Yeah, like kind of method acting. Yeah, right, right.
And the same thing can happen with D&D players. If their character is one that's required to behave in an evil way, then they may method act with that character and mentally cross the line into evil thought patterns.
Yeah.
And so if I had been Gary Gygax and Dave Arneson, who designed the game, I wouldn't have set up the alignment system that way to make that so easy for the characters, for the players to do with the characters.
Yeah, yeah, because we're psychologically vulnerable creatures in many ways. I mean, you can't just pretend to be evil all the time and
not have consequences.
Yeah. Jimmy Akin is our guest. It's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin today. We will take a quick break and we'll be right back with more weird questions that have come to us by various electronic means and perhaps otherwise. Maybe owls brought them or they were smoke signals. I'm not sure how they got here, but we're going to read them. Jimmy's going to answer them right after this.
This is Bishop Chad Zielinski from the Diocese of Fairbanks of Northern Alaska, and you are listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Underwriting for Catholic Answers Live is provided by Real Estate for Life. Real Estate for Life connects home buyers and sellers to real estate agents while supporting pro-life organizations. On the web at realestateforlife.org.
Are you a coffee drinker? If so, you can now enjoy a coffee roasted to perfection by the Carmelite monks of Wyoming. Delicious Mystic Monk coffee is roasted and prepared by monks in a hidden cloistered monastery and is available in over 25 varieties. All Mystic Monk coffees are works of perfection and labors of love. For more information on how to purchase Mystic Monk coffee, visit mysticmonkcoffee.com. That's mysticmonkcoffee.com.
Now, not only can you watch EWTN anywhere, but anytime with EWTN On Demand. Get on-demand access to more than 12,000 EWTN programs, including live shows and specials, all in one place, all free. Just go to EWTN.com/on-demand. There's nothing to fill out, no memberships required, and no fees to pay. All you need is an internet connection, and you're good to go. EWTN On Demand. Fast, easy, and free.
Jimmy Akin is here, the man behind Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Today's episode has to do with alien abduction.
Betty and Barney Hill.
And it's part two. So
yeah, I tell you what I think actually happened.
That's my spooky music.
Next two weeks, though, are going to be Third Secret of Fatima.
And will you tell us what you think really happened there, too?
Oh, absolutely.
All right. Fair enough. The next question comes from Tim via email. I wonder if this is Tim Staples. He's just like, oh, you know what? I'm going to ask Jimmy a weird question.
I doubt it.
All right. Catechism of the Catholic Church, paragraph 2290, have anything to say about people's addiction to coffee? We all seem to give coffee a pass, even though people spend lots of money on it and develop significant psychological and physiological dependence on it. Find any humorous coffee meme and substitute the word heroin, and suddenly it isn't so funny. So here we have...
What does the paragraph in the Catechism say? Why don't we read that for folks?
Catechism paragraph 2290 says, the virtue of temperance disposes us to avoid every kind of excess, the abuse of food, alcohol, tobacco, or medicine. Those incur grave guilt who, by drunkenness or a love of speed, endanger their own and others' safety on the road, at sea, or in the air.
Okay. So let's talk about this subject. First thing I want to mention is the concept of addiction. I'm not a big fan of the concept of addiction because when people say someone's an addict, they, number one, they're implying a moral censure, but even more fundamentally, they're implying that the person has a lack of control over the behavior. And I think that people who abuse various substances have more control than they are often credited for. And it's a disempowering message to tell someone you're an addict and so forth, when in fact the person has more control that they could exercise if they had self-confidence in themselves.
So the cookies really don't have power over me.
No, they don't.
All right.
Also, there's no objective definition for addiction. I'm not saying the term can never be used. I could imagine someone who is so physically dependent on some chemical that they will literally die if they don't get it.
Right.
But most people in most situations are not in that condition. And modern medical health professionals have even moved away from using the term addiction. If you look at the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders, the DSMR, it doesn't have addiction listed. It has substance abuse and substance dependence. And then there are different degrees of dependence where like, okay, I get a mild headache if I don't have my coffee, to I have a heart attack and die if I don't have my substance of choice.
Right.
And so this is a more sophisticated view that I think is better, a better model to approach than just slapping the term addiction on everything. So even though I can't rule out that there might be some people who are literally addicted to coffee in the extreme sense, I don't think that's true of most people. I think there are people who drink coffee a lot and maybe to a point where it causes them problems like nervousness or sleeplessness, or they get a headache if they don't have it. But I would tend to put that in the mild dependence or abuse area rather than a full-on addiction. And that's one reason why – so in – you know, the reason people take substances, whether it's coffee or heroin, the other substance that was mentioned, is because there's a perceived benefit to them.
Yeah.
In the case of coffee, they may want mental alertness, or they may like the flavor. In the case of heroin, it's because it makes them feel a certain way. But you then have to look at the downsides. And in the case of coffee, we mentioned some of the downsides. You know, you could get, you take too much of it, you can get nervous, you could, you know, jittery, you could have trouble sleeping, things like that. In the case of heroin, though, the downsides are much worse. Heroin destroys people's lives in a way coffee doesn't, or I should say regular heroin use does.
Right, yeah.
So that's one reason why if you take a coffee meme and substitute heroin, it ceases to be as funny because heroin is not as benign as coffee.
Yeah.
Having said that, so I'd say we want to keep this in perspective. Coffee is not as bad as heroin. Quote, unquote, coffee addiction is not the same as heroin addiction.
Right.
Having said that, I think that the relevant paragraph in the Catechism applies here. It says the virtue of temperance disposes us to avoid every form of excess. And then it lists some examples. You can have an excessive use of, what's the first one it names?
Food.
Food. Yeah. So you can eat too much. The next one is
alcohol.
You can have too much to drink. The next one is
tobacco.
You can smoke too much. The next one?
Medicine.
Medicine. You can take too much medicine. Mm-hmm. So all of those are forms of excess and they all should be avoided under the virtue of temperance. The same is true of coffee. There is such a thing as too much coffee. What that amount is going to vary from one individual to another. Most people, most of the time, if they do have an excess of coffee, it's not going to involve grave sin, but it is something that temperance would exhort one to avoid.
Yeah.
But this is not unique to coffee. This is everything.
Yeah.
There is even such a thing as too much water. Water toxemia is a real thing, and it can kill you. If you drink too much water too quickly, you will die. So even something as necessary for life as water can have excesses. And so I would say that the paragraph from the Catechism and the principle it articulates does apply to coffee, but it also applies to everything else. There is an excess in virtually everything, if not absolutely everything in human life.
Thank you, Tim, very, very much for that question. Robert on Twitter asks this, Jimmy, where would we be today if the Library of Alexandria never burned down? There are those who say we were set back 500 years.
It's certainly true that we don't have the Library of Alexandria, and it's certainly true that there are various historical sources that talk about it burning down, but actually scholars are not convinced of that. The library may have ceased to exist for other reasons besides burning down. And this is a bit of a historical mystery.
Oh.
But having said that, we can reframe the question of where would we be if the library had remained and we still had access to all of those ancient documents. The answer is there's no way to know. We presumably might, if we're judging things in a technological sense, we might be, a century or two ahead technologically if we had access to all of the science that the ancients knew and if that had had percolated throughout the ancient world from Alexandria and other people built on it. It's an interesting thought experiment, and one could certainly write an alternate history novel based on the library continuing to exist. And personally, I would love to have access to all of those ancient documents that are now lost, but there's no real way to tell for sure.
So just to put it kind of in a nutshell for Robert, you're saying that if the library still existed, we would probably be cyborgs now.
Not necessarily.
Did I miss some of the subtlety?
No, but and this is to give an alternate scenario. Okay, so let's suppose that technology progressed more quickly by 200 years.
Okay.
So instead of the atomic bomb being first deployed in 1945, it was first deployed in 1745.
Yeah.
Well, suppose other elements of our culture had not changed around the way they did. The only thing that's developed is that's extra developed is technology, but the rest of culture is just the same. Can you imagine what people in 1745 would have done if they had been able to make atomic bombs?
It would have been not good.
Yeah, it would have been not good. That was a very warlike period. We didn't have the international institutions.
Imagine the French and Indian War. And,
yeah. So we could be living in Commandy's time where, you know, civilization has fallen in a nuclear war and we have talking animals now. So that could happen.
I guess so. So not cyborgs.
Not cyborgs, yeah.
All right. Robert, thanks for that very, very interesting question. I kind of enjoy counterfactuals.
Mm-hmm.
I kind of enjoy just exploring them a little bit. But I had never thought of that particular counterfactual. But you know what, though? Maybe they would have discovered the New World sooner. And that would have, you know, because you would have had technology to all kinds of
more
things.
Earlier wars.
But yeah, exactly. It's Weird Questions. Jimmy Akin is our guest. We will be right back to throw more weird questions at him and see what kind of answers we get on Catholic Answers Live.
Catholic Answers Live.
Everybody's favorite Catholic outer space delivery pilots return for their greatest adventure yet in the brand new graphic novel Weapons of War. Fresh from saving the solar system in The Truth Is Out There and saving the timeline of salvation history in The Big Picture, Brendan and Irk land in a magnificent domed city on Mars for what is supposed to be a simple shuttle job. But soon they find themselves caught up in a sinister assault on faith and freedom. Will Mars be lost to the enemy? Brendan and Irk's only hope for the flight is in the power of God's sacramental gifts. A totally new kind of Catholic resource for apologetics and evangelization, The Truth Is Out There series combines the visual excitement and quirky humor of graphic novels with solid popular philosophy and theology. The result is a series in which everyone from teens to adults can find accessible answers to questions about God, the soul, true happiness, and much more. Order your copy of Weapons of War today by calling 844-239-4952, by visiting shop.catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Did you know you can access Catholic Answers Live right from your phone or other mobile device? Download the Catholic Answers Live app today. The Catholic Answers Live app, available now on iOS and Android.
If you're a Catholic who sometimes gets intimidated by the Bible, Jimmy Akin's The Bible is a Catholic Book will help you better understand and take pride in this gift that God gave the world through the Church. Don't let anyone tell you otherwise. Catholics are the original Bible Christians. Order your copy of The Bible is a Catholic Book today by calling 844-239-4952, by visiting shop.catholic.com, or asking for it at a good Catholic bookstore near you.
Are you haunted by a loved one's suicide?
Let's navigate this grief together on Monday's Take Two with Jerry and Debbie.
Now, let's get back to more of Catholic Answers Live.
Hey, groovy music.
Oh, yeah. There it is. That old-time groovy music. Just rocking and rolling here at Catholic Answers Live. Thanks very much, Nick Carlton Chamberlain, and that Carlton stands for the dance.
That's the Charlton.
Wait.
That's Charleston.
No, but I was thinking of a different dance.
Oh.
I was thinking of the guy from Fresh Prince of Bel-Air. Isn't he Carlton and he does that funny dance? Yeah. I always think of you as being named after that.
I would associate Nick Carlton Chamberlain more with the classic Charleston dance.
Nick is a classic.
Yeah.
He comes across as kind of a classic. Thanks for playing the groovy music, Nick. You're my best friend now. Until I forget that this happened.
Now I have the Charleston dance step in my head.
Dun, 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 dun. Oh, wait, I think that might have been...
That's The Entertainer by Scott Joplin.
Okay. Actually, I think I might have been doing the bar scene from Star Wars.
Oh, Cantina Band. Yeah, okay.
Okay, let's go to another weird question. Anne asks, I have a question. Thank you for starting that way, Anne. About
bodily mortification.
Okay.
She's reading Reform Yourself and Other Lives of Saints Who Did Actually Damage Their Physical Bodies. To me, that seems very wrong, as our bodies are temples of the Holy Spirit, and God created the body good, so much so that burial of the dead is an act of Christian charity. Yet we still are being advised in some quarters to subdue our bodies with either extreme and unhealthy neglect or actual harm.
So I would say that this is a real danger. That there are people who do damage their bodies through mortification in a way that results in permanent harm. And that's one reason why asceticism, any kind of significant asceticism, should only be practiced under the care of a spiritual director. You want an outside perspective to help you keep perspective on what you're doing and make sure that that the asceticism is fulfilling the goals that you have in mind for it, growing closer to God, things like that. You need someone to periodically say, okay, you've been fasting for, you know, growth in holiness. How's that going?
Yeah.
If you know, is it making a difference or not?
Right.
And how severe of a fast is this? Are you damaging your body or whatever it may be? You need an outside perspective of a mature, sound person to help you through that process as a check, because if you're engaging in an ascetic practice that is of a significant nature, your own perspective is not necessarily objective.
Right,
and so
right.
You want that outside perspective. Having said that, I can't rule out altogether the idea that that there are no scenarios where it's okay to practice asceticism to the point that there is some kind of ongoing physical damage. These would be rare scenarios that I can imagine, but I can imagine. Suppose there is someone who, and I don't know exactly how you'd know this, but suppose there was someone who the only way this person is going to avoid mortal sin at the point of death is if they have practiced some kind of extreme asceticism that gave them a physical mark to remind them not to commit mortal sin. Well, in that case, I would say that the good of the person's soul getting to heaven outweighs the harm that's physically done through the asceticism. This is a principle that St. Paul articulates in Scripture, where he talks about how exercise, for example, and bodily discipline is good to a certain point. And you know what they say about that? No pain, no gain.
Yeah.
The reason the pain is there, if you're, let's say, building muscle, is because you're tearing the muscle fibers. That's how you build muscle. You exercise to the point that you create microscopic tears in your muscle fibers, which then grow back stronger. And that's how muscle building works. So so you are doing some damage there, but good is coming out of it. And as useful as physical disciplines like this can be, St. Paul indicates that spiritual consequences, spiritual disciplines are of a higher value that help you grow closer to God and get a reward in heaven. And so I can imagine hypothetical scenarios where the greater good of an individual soul would be fostered by a form of asceticism that left a permanent mark on the body in some way. But that's not the norm.
Right.
And you don't want to make those judgment calls yourself. You want an outside spiritual director who can help you discern such situations, which is why in, for example, religious orders where they practice asceticism, everybody has a spiritual director.
Yeah. Yeah. To help you through that. Yeah. All right. Anne, thank you very, very much for the question. Up next is Philip. And Philip says, was Jesus really dead all day on Holy Saturday and just waiting to come out on Sunday?
I'm not entirely sure that I understand what he has in mind with this question. I can imagine two scenarios, and I'll address them both. One is where Jesus is dead all day Saturday and then rises on Sunday. And what the question means is, like, was he hanging out in the afterlife just waiting to come back to life on Sunday?
Okay.
The other, which I've also heard proposed, is that, oh, maybe he didn't remain dead all day Saturday. He came back to life on Saturday and then hung out in the tomb waiting to emerge on Sunday.
Okay.
I think the latter is not the case, because you have the statement made by Jesus himself that the Son of Man is going to be dead for 3 days and three nights. Now, that's actually a bit of hyperbole. He wasn't dead for a full 72 hours. But in accord with the ancient Jewish way of speaking, it means he was dead, not just in the tomb, but dead for all of Holy Saturday, part of Good Friday, and part of Easter Sunday.
Right.
So that's the 3 days. But in ancient Hebrew speech, they would round up. And so I think he was dead all day on Saturday, and then he rose sometime in the a.m. hours of Easter Sunday. I think that's the clear implication that we're given by the text. Having said that, in terms of like hanging out and waiting to emerge on Sunday, if he's in the afterlife, I would say that's somewhat unknowable, in part because time may not work exactly in the afterlife the way it does here. But we do have indications that Jesus did things in the afterlife, like preaching the gospel to the dead, redeeming the souls of the righteous so they could go to heaven, you know, things like that. So he apparently did do things while he was dead. What those things were and whether he had any relaxed time in that period, I would say is unknowable.
All right. Robert, Philip, thank you for the question. This one's from Robert. What would the implications be in terms of philosophy, theology, and morality if animals other than humans were discovered to be sapient?
Well, this is something I don't think is going to happen here on Earth.
They're talking rabbits.
Yeah, or other animals that have human-level cognition.
Yeah.
So sapient, it's good that he said sapient and not sentient. Sentient means you can feel, and actually animals can feel, so they are sentient. But sapient means wisdom. That's why we're Homo sapiens, man the wise.
Right.
And so when we talk about a creature having sapience, we would mean human-level cognition. And it appears that there are no animals on Earth that have human level cognition other than us. There are some that have varying degrees of cognition, and some obviously more than others, but nothing has human level cognition. Having said that, let's suppose, counterfactually, that that such animals came into being, or we discovered that, contrary to appearances, something really can think as well as we can.
Yeah.
They just didn't want to talk to us up to now for some reason, and we're playing some game hiding that from us.
Or maybe it's pixies, and they did talk to the Irish, but they didn't talk to anybody else.
Pixies wouldn't be animals to my mind.
Oh, yeah.
But,
okay, fair enough.
So suppose one way or another we end up with terrestrial animals that have human-level cognition. Now, if they're extraterrestrial animals, you know what we call them, right?
Extraterrestrials.
Aliens.
Yeah, oh, yeah.
Extraterrestrials. But if let's say someone did, I believe it's David Brin has a novel called Uplift, where various species will take other species and jack their intelligence level up.
Oh.
So if someone took a chimpanzee and uplifted it to human level cognition, I would say that that, number one, shouldn't be done. So the one question was about morality. I would say we shouldn't mess with other life forms in that way, because if you are a being with a rational soul, all life forms have souls. The question is it rational or not? Meaning, does it have human-level cognition? If it does, then even though it's not a human, I think you have to act on the presumption that it has the same rights that we do.
Mm-hmm.
And that makes it a moral subject. And so we would have to treat uplifted chimpanzees or uplifted dolphins or whales as beings that have the same kind of rights that humans do, even though they're not humans. Also, depending on their dispositions, it would get into, okay, do we evangelize them now? And I would apply the same criteria I would for extraterrestrials to them. That's something I talked about, episode 55, Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World, Aliens and Religion. So I created that episode so I'd have a one source go-to. Yeah. Just go to that for all these questions.
Yeah.
Philosophically, I think they would be rational substances like we are. And so that would they'd have to be treated as such in terms of the rights. But it would be wrong to do this because God has determined through his own plan how rational beings are to come into the world. In our case,
yes, right,
it's through human reproduction.
Yeah.
And using artificial means like test tube babies to create in vitro fertilization to create rational beings is not God's plan for our species. Same thing, uplifting chimpanzees is not God's plan for bringing new rational beings into the world. And so I would say it should not be done. It would be unethical.
All right. Thank you very, very much, Robert, for that question. Hey, don't forget, please, that if you're in the neighborhood somewhere around Omaha, Nebraska, on November 2nd, we'd love to see you. Spirit Catholic Radio, in cooperation with Catholic Answers, is putting on a big conference there. Tim Staples is going to be speaking on Jesus's radical call to discipleship. Trent Horn's going to be speaking on Why Be Catholic. I'll be giving a talk. Matt Fradd is going to give a talk. The great Dr. Ray Guarendi is going to be giving a talk. And space is limited. So you just go over to spiritcatholicradio.com. It's for All Souls Day. That's a Saturday. It's going to be at the Embassy Suites La Vista Conference Center there in Omaha. Hundreds of other Catholic folks gathered for just, it's going to be an exciting, fun, invigorating, inspiring, and informative day. So we'd love to see you there. Spiritcatholicradio.com is where you go to get all the information and to sign up.
This is Archbishop Salvatore Cordiglione of San Francisco. Thank you for listening to Catholic Answers Live.
Go forth and preach the good news. It's not just a suggestion. If you want to take more seriously the command of Jesus to share the gospel with those around you, consider joining St. Paul Street Evangelization. It's a grassroots organization that brings the Catholic faith to the streets in a non-confrontational way. Visit our website, www.streetevangelization.com, to learn more. And don't forget to like us on Facebook. It's time to do our part.
The wisdom of Mother Angelica.
Isn't it awesome that we today do not recognize his presence in the Eucharist? Is it because we really don't go to him in humbleness of heart and say, Lord, I don't believe, help my unbelief. Lord, I want to see you. I want to recognize you. I cannot live without you. Are we saying that?
EWTN. Live truth. Live Catholic.
Catholic Answers Live. I'm Cy Kellett, your host, enjoying a fun Friday afternoon with Jimmy Akin. It's Weird Questions with Jimmy Akin this hour. Jimmy, of course, is senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, the author of the brand new and very popular book, The Bible is a Catholic Book, which you can get in bulk and give it away to folks. You can get it in a case of 20 for $3 a book over at shop.catholic.com, or you can get it in, what's the opposite of bulk? In mono.
Single.
In single.
Single copies.
Yeah, at also there at shop.catholic.com. You wanted to follow up on something?
Yeah. So I mentioned the idea of uplifted chimpanzees and stuff like that. And it brought to mind a science fiction story I read a number of years ago. I believe the title was Monkey See.
Uh-huh.
And the premise of the story was Earth has joined a galactic federation. But one of the conditions for membership was we had to ensure equal rights for everybody on the planet. And the aliens who run the Galactic Federation do not see a significant difference between humans and chimpanzees.
Why would you?
So we have to give human rights to chimpanzees.
Right.
The problem is there are chimpanzees who are living in like research facilities in like animal preserves. So we can't just let them go. They're not used to caring for themselves.
Right.
What do we do? And so the solution that the caretakers came up with was we treat them as if they were human beings. If human beings behaved like this, they would be institutionalized. Yeah. So this is now a mental institution.
Yeah.
And the problem, and that works fine for a while, but then the aliens in the Galactic Confederation decide to send a doctor to cure them. And things do not go well.
Oh,
and it's a hilarious,
story.
Absolutely hilarious story. One of my all-time favorite sci-fi stories. I believe the book it's in is a collection a few years ago of alien-based mystery stories called What Done It's.
Oh, but okay.
Monkey See, it's a hilarious story. It's really good.
All right. Next up in Weird Questions, Amanda asks the following, Jimmy. And I like that she has asked the question and then a follow-up question.
Mm-hmm.
In dire circumstances, can one baptize with tea? It's mostly water. But here's the follow-up.
Okay.
What if it's sweetened?
Yeah. Well, okay. So let's answer both questions straight.
Yeah.
The standard theological understanding
yeah.
is that you could not use tea to baptize because even though it's mostly water, it is not natural water, which is the standard theological opinion has been you have to use natural water to baptize. So if in the opinion of an ordinary person, it's no longer water, if it's something else, then it is not valid matter. There is even a parallel case to this that the Holy See decided back in 1241 AD,
okay.
where they got a letter from a bishop in Norway. And you know, it's real cold in Norway. It's got lots of mountains and things. They apparently didn't have a lot of water, but they had beer. And uh-huh. so they were actually in Norway baptizing babies with beer,
yeah.
in some cases, on the same logic. It's mostly water. Well, they wrote the Pope, and in 1241, if I recall correctly, the Pope wrote back and said, such babies are not rightly baptized. You got to use water.
Bummer.
So do not baptize babies in beer, and by analogous reasoning, do not baptize babies in tea. Having said that...
Mm-hmm.
If one was in a situation where someone's about to die
mm-hmm.
and all you have is tea, though this is a theological opinion, it's not a defined church teaching. Hypothetically, someone might use it conditionally.
Oh, yeah.
Saying, if this matter is capable of baptizing you, I baptize you. I can imagine someone doing that as a hypothetical scenario. I'm not endorsing it.
Right.
But when someone's on the verge of eternity, you know, that would be
Give
the kind, if anything would be the kind of dire circumstance that would make that permissible, that would be it. Now for the second question,
what if it's sweetened?
You're laughing like this doesn't have a serious answer.
The thing is, it's not going to get more positive because you added more stuff to
that's,
it. That's
you,
all.
You have a correct intuition.
Okay.
Yes. So the farther something departs from being what a normal person would consider water, the more impurities you introduce into it of that nature, and adding sugar in whatever form, whether it's fructose or sucrose or something else, that is going to further make this invalid matter. So,
but it does make it more delicious.
It does make it more delicious, but it's going to not help you with the baptism.
All right, Amanda, no beer, no tea. Mark asks this, and I love this question. In confirmation class, a kid once asked me this, and Mark, thanks for teaching confirmation class. If
yeah.
there were an insane man who thought his cat was a priest, and he went to confession to his cat and heard the cat give him absolution, would his sins be forgiven? Nick is laughing out loud. Oh, it's Thomas laughing out loud at that. But that is a great confirmation class question.
Yeah. So the answer is that his sins would not be forgiven because he hallucinated a cat giving him absolution.
Right.
His sins might be forgiven, though, if in his delirium he made an act of perfect contrition,
right.
thinking I'm doing what God wants me to do, I'm loving God
yeah.
because he's so great, and I want to do what he wants, and he wants me to go to confession to this cat, and that's what I'm going to do. Well, if his in his delirium, he on some level made an act of perfect contrition, then even though the hallucination didn't absolve him, his sins would be forgiven because he made an act of perfect contrition. And once he hopefully recovers his right mind and realizes, oh, that cat thing didn't absolve me,
right,
then he would need to go to actual sacramental confession to complete the sacrament that his act of perfect contrition already initiated.
A couple things, Jimmy, if I may.
Uh-huh.
First, I am delighted
if
that this
kid is now.
If it's a dog,
it's the same thing.
No, I'm not going to ask you about a dog. I'm just so happy that this kid now is a confirmed fellow Catholic. I love the kid that had the thought. But I just want to ask you, this is for you personally.
Okay.
Because I think the answer to this is yes.
Okay.
Did you envision a black cat with kind of white down his throat?
No.
Oh, you didn't.
I envisioned a golden tiger cat.
I saw a black cat with a white down his throat. Why else would the guy think he was
a
priest?
I never had a black cat. I had a golden tiger cat when I was a kid. I had several cats, but the main one was this golden tiger cat, and it was huge. And I didn't realize it because, you know, it's just this cat. But a friend of mine is like, no, this is like a Flintstones-level giant cat. Yeah, his name was Goldie.
See, now, I don't think it was a cat. I think that that was a space alien visiting Jimmy Akin.
Maybe it was the Great Gazoo in
disguise. Keeping an eye on you. Sasha wants to ask this. I read that Augustine believed that concupiscence is specifically passed down through the act of intercourse of the parents, which leads to practical questions like, would concupiscence still be part of a child if there would be artificial insemination without any sexual act involved?
So concupiscence is disordered desire, and it's one of the consequences of original sin. And original sin is the deprivation of sanctifying grace. So because we're born deprived of sanctifying grace, we have a broken nature that results in disordered desire or concupiscence. Now, I'd have to do some checking on the details of exactly what Augustine said in this regard. I'm aware of the basic claim, but how I've always understood what he meant, and he may have had a somewhat different take, this is just my understanding of what he meant, is that human nature was incapable, in its fallen state, human nature is incapable of passing down the sanctifying grace that would be needed to prevent someone from having concupiscence, original sin, and thus concupiscence. So if our first parents had not fallen, then when they got together to make new little Incredibles, the human act would have passed down as a sacrament, would have passed down the original
grace.
Righteousness, and thus they wouldn't have the broken human nature and wouldn't have concupiscence. But because they lost this, they couldn't pass it down. And so I've always understood it in that light. And so given that, if you're circumventing God's plan, like with in vitro fertilization, you're coming up with a baby even without the human reproductive act, then, well, that's not going to get the grace of original righteousness passed down either.
Yes.
So, of course, people who are conceived by IVF are going to be like the rest of us. They're going to be deprived of sanctifying grace upon birth. They're going to have a broken human nature. They're going to have disordered desire. They're going to have concupiscence. And you can ask all of the people who have been conceived of IVF, do you ever have temptation? And they're going to say, yeah. So this seems to be experimentally verified.
Right. But if you start with it's a lack, it's not the presence of an additional thing.
Correct.
It's a lack of something.
And
that makes more
sense.
That's
true of evils in general, is always involve a lack of something good. And so concupiscence is a lack of something good.
Oh, so this makes me think of Jesus then. I mean, clearly he's God incarnate. All graces are mm-hmm. I mean, he bears all graces. But does Mary then, the fact that she's sinless means she can, I don't know, I guess I don't know what I'm saying, because he already
You're
had
asking,
all the graces.
Could Mary, if she had a child, have passed down original righteousness to that child?
Yeah.
The answer is undetermined.
Uh-huh.
Because she didn't have any other children, so we don't know.
But she didn't pass it to Jesus because
he had it
as
intrinsically.
God incarnate.
You could argue on a human level she was a vessel that God used to impart it to Jesus's human nature.
Oh.
However, it's not certain because some thinkers have also thought that it would be the male who would pass it down, or it could be the female, or it could be both.
Okay, fair enough. Jimmy Akin has been our guest. Jimmy's senior apologist here at Catholic Answers, and you should get his brand new book, The Bible is a Catholic Book. It is not a hard read. As a matter of fact, it's a very engaging read all the way through.
I'll even read it to you.
Oh, that's right. You have.
If you get the Audible audiobook version, which I narrated.
Right. And you can get Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World each Friday. Just Google Jimmy Akin's Mysterious World. Jimmy Akin, thank you very much.
Thank you, Cy.
Had a really good time.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ is the light of the nations. You know it's true. We'll see you next time on Catholic Answers Live.